Hey, this is the Takeaway Podcast for Friday, March 9th, 2018. You'll find six stories you need to know about today. If you like this podcast, tell your friends and rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.
A little less than a month after 17 people were killed at a high school in Parkland, Florida, there are signs of some legislative response across the country. For some of you, the movement is promising, and for others, it's not enough.
Anne Marie from Weddington, North Carolina.
Mike from Highland Park, Illinois.
This is Barbara from Brownsville, Oregon.
Byron from Portage, Indiana.
I'm Irene from Long Island. I'd like to see a ban on assault-style weapons, bump stocks, and high-capacity magazines.
I would very much like to see a permanent ban on any type of assault rifle as soon as possible.
It seems like lawmakers are just dancing around the topic of having stronger gun laws. They say they'll do something, but then they don't.
Our town already bans assault weapons. I don't understand why Congress hasn't brought up a bill for banning them nationwide.
There is no sane reason for any non-military person to have this kind of firepower.
Now, the students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, upended this debate in America by demanding action after last month's attack. They got on television, they headlined town hall meetings, they took on elected officials on social media, and they went to Tallahassee to lobby their state lawmakers. And that pressure appears now to be paying off. Here's House Speaker-designate Jose Oliva speaking to reporters at the end of last month.
The proposal that we will put forward will speak directly to every single failing that happened, so that we can walk away here knowing we changed this piece that failed, we changed this piece that failed, so on and so forth, so that we can truly say that if what we want is to know that we've ensured that this doesn't happen again, we've brought forth the legislation to do it.
And this week, on Wednesday, the Republican-controlled Florida House passed that bill. It also passed the state Senate and will be the first set of gun control measures to head to the governor's desk in Florida in 22 years. This is The Takeaway, and I'm Todd Zwillick. So, high-profile action in Florida, but what about other states, and what about Washington, D.C., where Congress, led by Republicans, has been unwilling to respond to mass shootings with action on guns? Alex Yablon is a reporter for The Trace. He's been tracking all the action around the country, and we started in Florida.
So, it's a compromise bill. It would raise the age for purchasing rifles in the state from 18 to 21. It would allow police to enact these so-called red flag gun seizures, you know, temporarily taking guns from people who are believed to pose an imminent risk to themselves or others, and it would ban bump stocks. But most controversially, it would also allow school districts to arm support staff. And that is the real kind of wild card here.
Now, the governor was asked about that on television just a couple of days ago.
So you don't agree with the president that we should be arming teachers?
No, I don't. I believe that we ought to make sure we have the law enforcement presence. We make sure that, they're trained.
Governor Rick Scott, Alex, saying he's not comfortable with arming teachers that's included in this bill, but he's going to sign it anyway.
Well, it's an open question as to whether or not he's going to sign it. I haven't seen a statement definitively from him either way. It would be really surprising to me if he didn't sign it, considering how much every other prominent Republican in the state has really put themselves out here to go against the NRA, and how much demand there is for some kind of action after this. If he doesn't sign this, it's hard for me to imagine another bill coming down the pike. It sort of seems like it's this or nothing.
Now, Florida was the home of the Parkland shooting, unfortunately, legislation in Tallahassee. Other states, though, have been moving as well. Take us to Oregon. What's going on there?
So there, the governor just signed a bill that extends the prohibition on gun ownership by domestic abusers to cover the so-called boyfriend loophole. You know, there's a federal ban on convicted domestic abusers possessing and purchasing guns, but it only applies to people who abuse spouses or people that they actually live with. but a lot of domestic abuse and relationship violence occurs in dating situations, people who don't live together, or in stalking situations. So the Oregon law would prohibit people who abuse partners that they don't actually live with, which a lot of clinicians consider a really strong indication that someone will go on to commit worse acts of violence.
Now, we've talked with you in the past on this show about domestic violence as a gateway, one of many, but a gateway to gun violence. So Oregon seems to be addressing that. What about Illinois?
Illinois pushed through a bill to create a state gun store licensing scheme. Obviously, the federal government licenses gun stores through the ATF, but the ATF has limited resources to actually inspect these stores to make sure they actually comply with laws. I think they only manage to inspect about 7% of gun stores a year. And they're also limited in what kind of documentation and security measures they can demand from stores. So now the state of Illinois can impose its own standards on gun dealers, you know, requiring that they adopt minimum safety standards like locking guns up after closing time or something like that. And they can impose additional record-keeping requirements on them so they keep better track of where their guns end up.
Well, there's some action in some other states as well. Now, these are mostly blue states we just talked about, Oregon and Illinois. In red states, there's been some pro-gun legislation that elected officials are sort of backing away from after Parkland, right?
Yeah. So in Indiana, there was a push before Parkland to allow guns in churches. And there's been a sense that now is not the time to push for laws that make it easier to bring guns into more public places. They've stepped back from that. In Utah, they were considering a permitless carry bill, which would allow anyone who can legally own a gun to conceal carry one wherever, you know, it's legal to do so. They're also stepping back from that in Utah. So now is not the time to pursue laws like this.
So, you know, Alex, after high-profile shootings, and we've talked about this script that America kind of gets into, we look for action in the states, in Washington. We're talking about this sort of smattering of legislative action around the country. Is this a moment of gun legislation, or is it just kind of we're paying attention to it now and it's still business as usual? What's going on out in the states?
It's certainly a moment, you know, I think especially in Florida, to see a law like this passed, even though it does rub a lot of Democrats the wrong way because of the provisions to armed teachers. It's really rare to see this many Republicans go directly against the wishes of the NRA. That's an indication that something is different this time. I don't know how long it'll last, but the movement that's been organized by these students is really something new.
Now, let's go to Washington and talk about what's going on at the federal level, including with the bump stock ban.
Right. So the bump stocks are something that bureaucrats in the ATF are looking at. Basically, they're trying to figure out a way to regulate or ban these devices without Congress having to vote on anything. Now, during the Obama years, the ATF was very reluctant to ban these things. They basically felt that the letter of the law was clear, that it didn't apply to bump stocks, that they weren't technically machine guns, so the ATF lacked the authority to regulate them. Now they're singing a different tune. They've apparently decided on a different reading of the law that will allow them to create some kind of regulatory scheme to prohibit future sales or regulate them.
Now, the House Republican leadership in Congress has said they're going to take a crack at some legislation next week. It's not gun legislation, though, although it is reactive to Parkland. What are Paul Ryan and the Republicans doing?
So they are really focusing on the school security angle. They are going to free up, I believe, about $50 million to give to states and local school districts to improve reporting on at-risk students, to install new security measures and things of that nature. But this is all stuff that kind of presupposes that shootings are going to happen and schools just need to be prepared to defend themselves when they do happen.
When the president says Congress is nearing a vote on universal background checks or some kind of gun control legislation, is he singing from the same songbook as congressional Republicans at all right now on that?
No.
He just isn't. What about the Senate? What's going on in the Senate?
In the Senate, you know, Mitch McConnell has been pretty clear he doesn't intend to bring any kind of gun legislation to the floor anytime soon. Mitch McConnell is very wary of splitting Republicans between the most conservative members who really wouldn't accommodate any kind of new gun laws and those who want to try to address guns themselves. There have been a bipartisan group of senators who do want to address guns directly. John Cornyn and Chris Murphy have been pushing for a bill for several months now, ever since the Sutherland Springs shooting, to fund states to improve record reporting to the background check system. There's also a couple groups of senators, Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal, for instance, who have introduced bills that would encourage states to create these so-called red flag laws, the temporary gun seizure bills. So there is an appetite on both sides of the aisle for action, but it's not clear if Mitch McConnell will let anything proceed.
So, Alex, there's been another phenomenon in Washington this week. Of course, students from Stoneman Douglas High School have been advocating, doing media interviews, very active on social media for stricter gun laws, a huge part of this national debate, the students from this school. But another Stoneman Douglas student named Kyle Kashev has also been in Washington this week. He appeared with Senator Ted Cruz. He appeared with Paul Ryan. He went to the White House this week, and he does not favor any new gun legislation. And Republicans in Washington seem to be clamoring to appear with this young man from Stoneman Douglas High School. It's a very interesting kind of counter messaging that's going on with a student from that school. What's going on?
You know, it's quite common after incidents like the Parkland shooting for survivors to take different perspectives on the best course of action. These are not settled questions in our political life, but it's clear that Republicans are very eager to have someone so close to the situation who can provide them with some rhetorical cover for not pursuing gun legislation, strictly defined.
Alex Yablon, reporter for The Trace. Alex, thanks as always for helping us out.
Thanks for having me.
We want to build our ships. We want to build our planes. We want to build our military equipment with steel, with aluminum from our country. And now we're finally taking action to correct this long overdue problem. It's a travesty. Today, I'm defending America's national security by placing tariffs on foreign imports of steel and aluminum.
Well, President Trump made it official on Thursday, a 25% global tariff on steel, a 10% tariff on aluminum, and it all takes effect in 2 weeks. Business leaders and a lot of congressional Republicans pleaded with the president not to impose these tariffs. So did White House economic advisor Gary Cohn, who resigned this week, largely over the issue, it seems. Now the tariffs are global, of course, but there's also a NAFTA negotiation going on. And so for now, Mexico and Canada are exempt. Anna Swanson writes about trade and international economics for the New York Times, and she's here to get to the bottom of some of the implications of the president's tariffs. Anna, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, these tariffs, 25%, 10%, what do you think might be some of the more immediate implications of the president's decision here?
Well, they are pretty broad, very high tariffs, as you noted. And with that, they will hit a range of industries and countries around the world. So I think one of the first impacts is that tariffs will cause prices to rise. For the companies that make steel and aluminum in the United States, that's a very welcome relief. However, there are a lot of industries that, of course, use steel and aluminum to make other products, things like cars, washing machines, things you might not think of, like buildings often use a lot of steel as well, for example. And the prices for those things will rise as well. So a lot of companies have complained that these tariffs might end up shrinking their profits and ultimately end up costing them jobs. And then, as you noted, the tariffs will take 2 weeks to go into effect. In the interim, we have a period where countries are going to be arguing for exemptions. And so we'll see some quite furious lobbying over that in Washington.
Well, Anna, let's look at these tariffs in the context of other trade moves on the international scene. The president pulled us out of TPP, as promised, pulled away from NAFTA altogether to renegotiate, not altogether, but to renegotiate it, as promised. What's the longer game here when you look at tariffs in the context of everything else? What other measures do you think the administration is going to take in the months and years to come to realize the president's trade vision here?
There are a number of trade actions that the administration has already pursued and that are still in the works. But I think this one is really the first big manifestation you see of President Trump's promises to take a very different tack on trade. He did withdraw from that trade deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which actually the 11 remaining countries went ahead and signed yesterday, just as the president was signing tariffs. Kind of a symbolic moment, right, for the U.S. departing from the rest of the world. And he also put some tariffs on solar cells and washing machines earlier this year, but the steel and aluminum tariffs are much bigger and broader and much more consequential in their effects than anything we've seen so far. They are considering some other measures to come. We still don't know what will happen with NAFTA. That negotiation is ongoing and could affect a lot of companies and industries. And then the administration is also working on a potentially very large trade measure that involves China to penalize that country for stealing American intellectual property. And that could bring more tariffs or potentially some restrictions on investment as well.
Well, the fears of a trade war or at least an escalation seem to be very real. Let's bring it back home for a second, Anna, because you mentioned NAFTA. Mexico and Canada were notably exempted from this tariff negotiation. Is that a negotiating tactic with Mexico and Canada there? No tariffs yet?
I think so. So in the actual proclamation that they signed yesterday, it talked a lot about national security and how Canada and Mexico are important to U.S. national security. I think they did that for legal reasons because these tariffs are designed to be about national security and protecting the U.S. industrial base. But if you listen to the rhetoric of the president and others in the administration, they're basically saying that Canada and Mexico having these tariffs is contingent on a good outcome for the U.S. in the NAFTA negotiations. And it's still not clear to me how Canada and Mexico will respond to that. Yesterday, you saw Canadian and Mexican officials say they wouldn't be bullied and that they weren't going to consider issues outside of the negotiation in the negotiation. On the other hand, especially for a country like Canada, which ships a lot of steel and aluminum to the United States, those are important industries. So could it sway that negotiation in the months to come? Could it amp up the pressure and possibly lead to the U.S. withdrawing or doing something more detrimental to the pact? We'll have to see.
So, Anna, we have to run, but when we watch these international trade negotiations, it's kind of hard to know, how's this going to affect me when I go to the store? Is there an item, are there things that people buy every day that they should be on the lookout for price increases if they're going to know that these clashes are starting to affect them?
So I actually think for a lot of consumers, the products that they buy, the price increases won't be that noticeable. The administration has held up the example of like a soup can or a pop can and said that, you know, it's just a fraction of a cent. When it comes to a $20,000 car, the cost increase might be more like a few hundred dollars. So not something you're going to immediately notice. However, the issue, economists say, is that when you multiply those costs across the broader economy, you're starting to talk about billions and billions of dollars. And that's just not something the economy or American people necessarily need right now. There could also be some other potential effects in terms of retaliation. For example, farmers, which ship a lot of soybeans abroad, are pretty worried about the potential for retaliation on their products. So the effects might be felt more keenly in some industries that are export-based. If that's part of your job, you could see potentially a slowdown from some of this.
And if there's a further escalation in the future, as you say, could be in the offing with technology transfers or intellectual property with China, these trade issues start to escalate and the price increases could start to permeate. I guess we don't know yet, but Anna Swanson, thank you for joining us. Appreciate your guidance with these confusing trade deals. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Anna Swanson covers trade and international economics for The New York Times. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. A story now of an environmental struggle in Alabama that came to a head this week in Washington, D.C. The Arrowhead landfill opened up next to Uniontown, Alabama in 2007. 2 years later, trains began arriving, bringing in more than 4 million tons of toxic coal ash more than 300 miles from Kingston, Tennessee.
I grew up in the area, and a lot of people just, you know, they say, well, I got sick this way, and I've noticed a lot of health issues has changed. Kidney problems, heart problems, asthma, all kinds of problems.
Esther Calhoun is president of Black Belt Citizens for Health and Justice. They're a grassroots group that organized against the landfill. Uniontown, Alabama is more than 90% African American. And in 2013, Esther Calhoun and the other residents of Uniontown filed a complaint with the EPA, arguing that the Alabama Department of Environmental Management violated their civil rights by allowing the landfill to be built so close to Uniontown. But this week, the EPA dismissed that complaint, saying they'd found insufficient evidence that the Alabama Environment Department violated the civil rights of the residents of Uniontown. Ms. Calhoun disagrees, and she has health problems of her own that she suspects could be caused by the coal ash.
I have neuropathy, and also I have sleeping disorder. I noticed a lot have happened to my health since the landfill has been in. A lot of environmental justice is in our community.
Now, you appealed to the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, saying that what the Alabama Department of Environmental Management did here, allowing this dumping, violated the civil rights of the people in Uniontown. Why is this a civil rights violation in your view?
You know, you see the community, black community, poor community, all the one that's targeted. Only thing you have to do is look at the history of EPA and the history of black community, poor community. These things happen in these communities. And we don't have anyone to protect us, not the state nor the federal government.
Well, the EPA has said they don't have sufficient evidence to conclude that this is a civil rights violation in Uniontown, in your town. Ms. Calhoun, what are your next steps?
Oh, we're going to keep fighting. We're going to keep telling. We give them evidence. Evidence is saying, look at our health. How can we get data when you live in a poor area? You look at, okay, how can we get our water tested? Where are we going to get the money from? You know, it's so many things that we have to struggle to get the evidence. You know, like right now, I believe that we have testing of our water, that we have lead, we have arsenic in our water. So where did that come from? Did it just drop out the sky?
Now, you talk about evidence. Is the state testing the water? Is anybody sending a scientific team to Uniontown to get to the bottom of this first question I asked you, which is coal ash causing health problems in Uniontown? Is anybody looking at it?
We having different colleges coming here testing the water and doing different things. UAH came in and tested different. Ms. Dobbins came out and tested. You know, my thing is, who's protecting who? EPA, you seem like, okay, this is down here. Why aren't y'all providing testing? Okay, we're complaining. Why aren't anybody helping us? They should be protecting us. That's what EPA said, Environmental Protection Agency. But they're not protecting us. They protect rich neighborhoods. Why about us? What about the poor people? What about the black people? We are human beings too. We have human rights too. That's where it starts at. You know, if they do their work, we wouldn't have a problem. I think investigate. Is there a problem? And when we give evidence, okay, come and see if the evidence is true. Send your specialist down here and see if there's health problems or whatever else. But they're not doing that. They're not doing that. They just taking, okay, y'all don't have evidence. Come have a testing done yourself. Come do a data to see how people's health has changed and what their problems are. Help us solve this problem.
Ms. Calhoun, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Esther Calhoun is president of Black Belt Citizens for Health and Justice.
The way I see it, you and me got one thing to talk about, and that's what you are willing to do for me.
You should reward me accordingly.
Which bothers some men. The word itself makes some men uncomfortable.
I volunteer as tribute.
You're going to find out that we're wanted in two states and probably considered armed and dangerous.
So the women of Hollywood in the movie Montage today. I heard a bunch of voices I recognize for sure. A little bit of Big Lebowski in there, Rafer, right?
I think so.
Other great ones too. Thelma and Louise and some other great films too. Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday and for us here at The Takeaway. Great to see you again, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
We have one big release today and also a release today. Let's get to the big release in a minute. Let's get the big release. And to do that first, we have to get to the release, and I can see a look on your face about The Strangers, Pray at Night. This is a sequel, a follow-up to The Strangers.
That's right.
Right? Here's a clip.
Guys, the door's not even locked.
Is Tamara home?
You lost or something? You want me to call someone? You okay?
Rafer, three masked psychopaths make life a living torture for our protagonists.
That's right. Pretty much the same premise as the original film 10 years ago, The Strangers. a different director, different writer. You've got these three masked killers, two women, one man. They're preying on a family that has gotten to a trailer park. Christina Hendricks plays the mother. I would say she's sort of ill-used in this film. I was not a big fan of the first film. Found that movie very depressing and sort of not that interesting, not that inventive. It was really just sort of watching three people torture a couple other people who then sort of grow weary of it and then finally kill them.
Okay.
Yeah, it was sort of what I called bummer horror.
Yeah.
And this is also kind of very much the same thing. It's not exciting, thrilling, interesting. There's no theme. You don't know who these mashed killers are. They don't have an MO. And so eventually you're just watching people kind of die.
Kind of do bad things to one another.
Yeah. And, if you want to see some people stabbed, this is your movie. Otherwise, I'd say that's about it.
Okay. Well, let's move that to the side, if you don't mind, because there's a big release out, Wrinkle in Time, from director Ava DuVernay, hugely anticipated. Oprah Winfrey's in it. So is Reese Witherspoon. Most people know what this film is about. The children's favorite is coming to the big screen, and here's a clip.
Call me Mrs. What's It.
Mrs. Who?
No, Mrs. What's It. Mrs. Who is, she's like a billion years older and way more knowledgeable.
That's young star Storm Reid at the spear point of this movie with Reese Witherspoon there, Rafer.
That's right. So a lot of hopes riding on this.
Yeah.
The Madeleine L'Engle book is a huge favorite. Very complicated, kind of strange book, not easy to wrap your head around. Here's the big film version from Disney. And I think also this comes right on the heels of Black Panther, and a lot of talk in Hollywood about diversity and inclusion, African-American director. As you said, Oprah Winfrey, Mindy Kaling is in this, so a very, multicolored cast. I wish I liked this film better than I did, and I don't think I'm the only one. It just doesn't hang together. It feels very corny. It doesn't feel original to me. It feels like it's borrowing a little bit from Narnia and other movies that I've seen before, and I wanted a bit more of an original, kind of interesting world, and it just didn't give it to me. It felt like a bit of a pastiche of other kids' films that I've seen, and that was disappointing to me.
Did it not have a lot of weight, a big release like this, and watching the trailers, I thought that maybe this film would have some weight to it because of the moment and because of what they had on offer?
Yeah, I mean, I think we kind of all expected that. I will say there's a lot of what do I want to say? There's a lot of building up of this character, of this African-American girl who's a misfit girl at her school. She's bullied. It's not a race issue. She's just kind of a misfit girl. And there's a lot of, boosting her and telling her that she's beautiful, which I think is really good and great to see in a movie, something you don't see a lot of with a girl of color as your lead character in a movie like that. And that was great. I just wish that there had been a little more oomph there to the whole proceedings. Oprah Winfrey, I don't know.
Sure.
I'm not sure you can really cast Oprah Winfrey in a role anymore. She's too,
Oprah.
She's too Oprah,
yeah.
to be in anything.
Hard to not be Oprah when you're already Oprah, and that's understandable. Still, I think millions of kids are going to see this film, probably still a great thing, even if the big kids don't like it so much, right?
I think that's right.
Rafer, thanks for joining us. Rafer Guzman, film critic with Newsday.
Thanks, Todd.
Thanks for being with us today on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Fantasy and sci-fi books that share a piece of the Black experience are hugely popular right now. Of course, we have the box office hit, Black Panther, and today, with a lot of big expectations, Ava DuVernay's Wrinkle in Time opens in theaters across the country. But there's also a new book out this week that's getting a lot of buzz. Children of Blood and Bone is the first in a series of young adult books by Nigerian-American author Tomi Adeyemi, who at 24 years old got a seven-figure deal for her West African-inspired story that draws on parallels of police brutality and empowerment of women and girls and dissects them in the fantasy world of Orisha.
We like adventures. We love adventures. We love Lord of the Rings. We love Harry Potter. We love The Hunger Games. And I think all, young adult authors who are especially writing in, the fantasy or sci-fi genre, we're all influenced by that. Like, a lot of us, we are in the Harry Potter generation, so we grew up with this amazing magic. We grew up with it in the books, and then we got to see it in the movie, so that was a big influence. And then I think for the authors writing today, like, the Hunger Games really changed the game because, you know, Harry Potter got really dark at the end. The Hunger Games started there. And it was sort of the proof that you could deal with real issues, like real ugly, dark issues in books for teens, and they can handle it. And not only handle it, like, they can really process, they can think deeply about it.
This is a heroine story for sure.
Yeah.
Themes of community, themes, there's lots of magic. And an action scene.
Yeah.
Right off the bat, page one, where the fighting starts.
Yeah.
And your heroine, Zaylee, there's one scene where a big weapon is coming at her, and she leans back so far that I'm thinking this is like Neo in the Matrix.
Yes!
She's like all the
I'm
way backed
so
up,
happy.
Right?
I'm so happy that you said that. It's funny because, like, when I'm writing these action scenes, I'll have real references. So I'll be looking at, like, fights with staffs. I'll be looking at – it's funny. Now I'm really into MMA. So when I'm writing fight scenes, I'm like, okay, and then, like, pivot and really get there with the elbow and use your hips. But for that scene, for that arch, I was like, yeah. In my head, I saw it like the Matrix.
Yeah.
So the fact that you saw that, like, that just made my day.
And shows on page one or two, I don't know what it is,
yeah,
that Zaylee is an exceptional warrior.
Yeah.
I mean, she's going to be the heroine of this story. She's,
yeah,
not just learning to use a staff with two or three dozen other girls, as
exactly
it happens, but she's special.
I love the idea of these young girls who aren't supposed to be fighting, kind of like mini Mulans. Really, they're in there and they're learning how to fight, and not necessarily because there's a war, but because they believe, like, we need to know how to defend ourselves.
You have said that Black Lives Matter was,
yeah,
an important inspiration, an important influence for you,
yeah,
in crafting this book and in crafting the universe where it takes place. Mm. Why is that?
This book, it started in 2016, and that was emotionally a really rough year because it felt like every week there was another hashtag. There was another video of a Black man or a Black child or a Black woman being killed by the cops. And it was just sort of this back-to-back, like, okay, you're going to be, you know, hunted. You know, you're going to be killed. Your dad's going to be killed. Your mom's going to be killed. Your brother's going to be killed. You are going to be killed. Your sister's going to be killed. Like, you know, you can hear it in my voice, but that is what it felt like constantly. And then it was like, oh, also, there will be no justice from it, and there will be no change. But internally, back-to-back-to-back, there's a lot of emotional PTSD. And for me, I was so upset, but then it turned into like an anxiety attack because I was so scared. But it's also something that I think people need to know. So with the book, it, on one hand, it's like this epic adventure, you know, I'm like, it's Black Panther with magic, you know, so you have that wonderful adventure, you have that magic, you have that action. But on another layer, it is me sort of working through all of these things and also putting it in a fantasy world so that people can see it without their prejudices. Because when you say something like Black Lives Matter, there's going to be listeners that go, wait, all lives matter, blue lives matter. All, you know, like the intention gets twisted really fast in our world. So I was like, let me take the same exact concept. Let me take the same exact obstacles, conflicts, kind of like the systems of oppression. And let me just show that to you in another world so that your first instinct isn't actually this or this. It's like, oh, that's really messed up.
Did you channel some of that anxiety, some of that tension you were feeling into Zaylee?
It literally is all, like, from that day I was talking about, the day where I was like having an anxiety attack, I wrote a scene that actually ended up in the book. And through like 40 drafts and hundreds of revisions, that scene has been like mostly unchanged. So for Zaylee really is sort of that. I was able to channel a lot of my emotional PTSD through her because I was putting her through a lot of same things. They're very different. You know, this is a different world, but she was facing the same conflict. So I was able to keep it really human because I'm like, I know exactly how you're feeling. I can write exactly how you're feeling because I'm feeling that too, or I have felt that.
There's a lot of class strife, mm-hmm, in this world, and entire classes of people that are kept down by the royalty, by the monarchy.
Yeah.
I don't want to say who. But Amari is your princess.
Yes.
She's central to the story. Who is she?
She's the, like, exact opposite of Zaylee. So whereas Zaylee is, you know, she's ready to fight. She's ready to do whatever it takes to protect the people she loves. Amari is really sheltered. Very few people in her life actually see her for her. And she knows that there are some problems with the world, but she's in a very privileged position. So she'll do what she can without rocking the boat. But she's put in a situation where she either needs to really rock, not even rock the boat, like jump out of the boat, or just accept that like that is going to be her life. So she's put in that position, and the decision she makes forces her to go on really another epic journey of her own, and not just epic in the scale of the things she has to deal with, but internally. So she has a really interesting journey, and that was fun to write because it's through really working to figure out what her story and her journey was, she actually became like my favorite journey in the entire book.
So your story is coming into the world in the age of Black Panther.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's literally amazing. Someone was saying, what do you think the relationship is? And I was like, I think it's T'Challa and Shuri, because like where Black Panther and Wakanda is sort of the sci-fi imagining of Africa, Children of Blood and Bone is this fantasy imagining. So they're in dialogue with each other without like imposing on each other. You know, they have giant rhinos, I have giant lions, you know? So I was like, okay, we're good. We're really cohesive right now. But it's giving us that experience again, but with a completely different story, with a female protagonist, with Children of Blood and Bone. It's this epic adventure, but it's an allegory for the modern Black experience. So it's like woven within every page. And yeah, so I'm so excited. I feel also Ryan Coogler made my job so easy because Black Panther with magic, everyone's eyes like light up and people are like, awesome, I'm in. And I'm like, cool.
The book is Children of Blood and Bone. It's out this week.
Yeah.
Congratulations on this moment.
You.
And congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much.
That was Tomi Adeyemi, author of Children of Blood and Bone. And you can hear a longer version of my interview with Tomi on our website at thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, check out our new look. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. In 1969, while civil rights marches raged across America, there wasn't a lot of protest going on in Laramie, Wyoming. The people in Laramie liked things the way they were, and they liked college football. But that fall, 14 Black players on the University of Wyoming football team wanted to make a statement about racial discrimination in the Mormon church after the way they were treated the year before at a game against Brigham Young. The players became known as the Black 14, and they found themselves in the center of a civil rights standoff in a place where nobody wanted one. The story came to the attention of director Darius Clark Monroe in 2015.
After I looked at the footage and after I researched, I realized that there was a different perspective I wanted to shed, which is that this is not just the story of the Black 14, but this is a story actually about white identity and a community, a school and a system and a state and a government that supports an ideology that makes essentially no sense.
In a 14-minute film called Black 14, Monroe documents the story of Guillermo Hysaw, just 21 at the time, and his 13 teammates. The film is culled entirely from archival footage from around the time of the protest nearly 50 years ago.
I wanted to be sure that I did not doctor or misconstrue any idea that was coming out of the mouths of the people that were in this footage. I felt like it was important to allow people to speak on their own terms. One of the older white women is asked, do you know what's going on? She says, yeah, I do. And it's kind of sad that we have to do this thing, things like this here. To me, I want to investigate why it's kind of sad that we have to do these things here, as opposed to this is wrong, that these men are speaking for truth and they should be valued as humans. They should be valued as individuals who represent this institution. But that psychology did not connect.
That's Darius Clark Monroe, director of the film Black 14. I sat down with Guillermo Hysaw, who now, at age 69, recalls every detail around the game that started it all.
What was behind it was the prior year's game in Provo, Utah, where, you know, we were accustomed to back in the 60s, and I'm sure some of it still happens, the gouging and the name-calling and the berating that goes on in the pile when you get tackled. But what was very disturbing was at the end of the game, we're cheering, we look across the field, the other team had completely disappeared, so we're wondering, hey, we don't get to shake hands. So we start to run across the field to go to the locker rooms, and they turn the sprinklers on. So we get to the, we had to run through the water to get to the locker room, and when we got there, of course there was some illustrations on the wall, a black man and facing a gorilla. And none of it really, you know, made any sense until the next day when the headline in the newspaper, not the sports page, said Brigham Young washes evil off the field. So they had to sanitize the field because black people had played a game and had soiled their field. And then it went into the whole history of how the Mormons were being kicked out of different places from New York all the way to the salt flats of Utah. And along the way, Brigham had a revelation that basically said that black people were descendants of, depending on whether you read the Book of Mormon or different historians, Cain, who killed Abel, or Ham, who was the son of Noah that had discovered his father on the ark in the nude. Either way, we were descendants because those two individuals were dark-complected, so they were cursed. And the curse was that blacks could not ascend to heaven after death, and the highest that we could attain in life or death was to become a Mormon priest. But since we were the lowest order of life, which was lower than the primate, so then we, so that's where the gorilla comes in, we couldn't even become a Mormon priest. The irony of it was we were saying, what did that have to do with the football game? You know, what did that have to do with, you know, us coming there and playing? This isn't the first time that Wyoming had played BYU, but it was the first time that that number of African Americans were on the team. And so Coach Eaton wasn't at that game in Provo. So we wanted to bring him up to speed on what had happened, how it made us feel, and what did we think was appropriate to demonstrate how we felt and how we were made to feel. We came up with the idea of a black armband with 14 on it because it was 14 of us involved. And we wanted to show him, you know, this is an idea that we have. What do you think about this?
Mr. Hysaw, the coach's reasoning, his pretext at the time was that demonstrations by football players just aren't allowed, and that forming groups within the team isn't good for group cohesion. It's not good for the team, so that's not allowed either. That it wasn't about race, it wasn't about anything else. Did you buy that then, and do you buy it now?
No, because there was no rule, unless he made it up on the way into the field house. There was nothing in our letter of intent. We never had a discussion about that in any team meetings, whether it was two-a-days or football class or regular season meetings. No one had ever been told about any rule, and more specifically, it was about factions and demonstrations. And if there was a violation of it, he could have told us that when he talked to us in the field house. But we didn't hear that until there had to be a justification for his action. And by the way, he didn't have the authority to kick us off the team. Wyoming was a state-supported institution. Therefore, we were treated as employees of the state. That's why Governor Hathaway came in, and he had to actually fire us. So we were fired officially. We weren't kicked off the team. But Eaton had exercised what he thought was his authority to terminate our scholarships and our ability to play on the team.
Darius, how did you find this story of the Black 14, and what propelled you to make this film?
Yeah, I was fortunate that this story was brought to me in 2015 by another filmmaker who happens to be from Wyoming. This story had been written about, you know, all of the country. Sports Illustrated had been on national news, and yet the angle or the approach of how to tell this story was pretty much consistently the same. After I looked at the footage and after I researched, I realized that there was a different perspective I wanted to shed, which is that this is not just the story of the Black 14, but this is a story actually about white identity and a community, a school and a system and a state and a government that supports an ideology that makes essentially no sense in terms of that it's rarely focused on, that these individuals who, and everyone that you saw in the film is presented as very polite, very upstanding, and they're even asked a question and give you a true response. When one of the older white women is asked, do you know what's going on? She says, yeah, I do. And it's kind of sad that we have to do this thing, things like this here. to me, I want to investigate why it's kind of sad that we have to do these things here, as opposed to this is wrong, that these men are speaking for truth and they should be valued as humans. They should be valued as individuals who represent this institution. But that psychology did not connect.
And everyone in your film speaks for themselves. There's no narration.
Right.
There's no script. This is archival footage, but only archival footage.
Right. And so outside of editing the footage, I wanted to be sure that I did not doctor or misconstrue any idea that was coming out of the mouths of the people that were in this footage. I felt like it was important to allow people to speak on their own terms.
Mr. Hysaw, when you watch this film, there are lots of parts where you, as a young man 50 years ago, sound almost defeated. You're there protesting, but you say at one point, what are we even fighting for here? The coach gets what he wants. Maybe we should just pack up and go home. When you look back now, 50 years on yourself, do you remember how you felt when you were saying that?
Absolutely. Putting things in perspective, the 60s era was a time of social change, but it wasn't just in communities. It was in sports with Billie Jean King, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Bill Walton and Jim Brown and others that you named, because I was wearing the medallion with John Carlos and Tommy Smith, and I had been in the Junior Olympics with them when they actually raised their fists. So I was there and witnessed it. The defeatist feeling resulted from the fact that the coach in his monologue started out saying, most of you come from split homes and broken families, don't even know who your fathers are. I'm the only father that most of you will ever know. And by wearing those black armbands, you would be defying me. So it started with those comments, and we had never heard the coach obviously speak in those terms. Then it was more deflating when we actually had the meeting with the Governor Hathaway and President Carlson of the university with the state legislature, because again, we were employees of the state. And listening to everybody go around the room and share their perspective about how they felt and why they felt this was an appropriate action, an appropriate platform to show that we were opposed to the religious views being brought on the playing field. It was when the governor actually called Coach Eaton's home, and he was going to get him over to the president's office to speak with us, get it resolved, and we would be playing football the next day, according to the governor. He gets on the phone, and the governor says, hey, I'm over here with the 14 members of your team that were dismissed earlier today, and I wanted you to come over to the meeting and hope we could get things resolved. For the first time, we heard him say, I'm not leaving my warm house and coming over and talking to those niggas. And everybody in the room kind of looked in shock, and he was trying to push the mute button and what have you. So that was the first time we had heard that out of his mouth. And so there's a point in any person's life where you want to give up and you feel like, you know, what's the purpose? You know, what's the value of this? We had already lost our scholarships. That meant some of us weren't going into the pros. We didn't realize how we were going to be, and I call it whiteballed, but the common term then was blackballed, and kept out of job opportunities, kept out of other major schools, even ones that supported us. They didn't want us to come in because they thought that we would do the same thing at their school.
Well, today, Mr. Hysaw, I know that you've seen the protests on the field in the NFL, players taking a knee against injustice, Colin Kaepernick and a lot of other players too. What are you thinking about today when you see that going on and you see the reaction to it from fans across the country and also from the President of the United States?
I think the difference is his issues are off the field.
A lot of times it felt like lip service, because so much of it I felt was about Kaepernick getting re-signed. And, you know, is a team going to take him on? Is he being blackballed because he's not going to be able to play on the team? And so that's always felt interesting as a conversation, because to me, there's another discussion that Kaepernick can have, which is, why is the whole entire league white, the ownership? Why does this feel like a plantation Why do the owners speak to the players as if they are children? Why do we have this paternalistic ideology in terms of the way the sport should be ran? What about CTE? What about the damage to the brain, to the mind, to the body, to the spirit? What about the fact that we're taking young men, particularly young black men, who a lot of them come from impoverished communities that were already decimated through racist inactions and redlining, and we are pulling them from their communities and putting them in these white colleges and then bringing them into this league that doesn't really respect anything about them or their family or their community. To me, that's, I feel like, what Kaepernick should say, because I thought the conversation would be about the league itself being an issue.
You know, one of the things that struck me when I was watching your film, Darius, was that a lot of the reaction, sort of the cliched reaction today to Colin Kaepernick and the rest of it, is shut up and play.
Yeah.
Right? Back then, when Mr. Hisaw was protesting, it was just shut up.
Yeah.
There was no play. Yeah. They didn't want him to play. You're gone. You're done.
Yeah. Yeah. Now it's money. And so if you do shut up, but that's, again, that's how this system works. If you're quiet, if you don't push back, and if you essentially behave like a cog in a wheel, then you won't have a lot of backlash. I think, you know, the average NFL fan would probably say, no, I'm not racist. No, I'm not racist. I love black people. I love these players. But the second they step outside of the stadium, or the second they stop referring to the actual men who are on the team, it's a completely different mindset. And that's a problem to me.
Mr. Hisaw, in one of the final bits of Darius's film, you're talking to a reporter, and you say at one point that you would meet Coach Eaton again, that you'd be ready to meet him again. Do you remember what you meant by that? And of course, I have to ask you if you ever did see him again.
At the time, I felt that I didn't do what I should have done. Meeting him again, I would have forced my view and my voice to be heard by speaking up, by standing up, by cutting him off like he cut us off in terms of standing up. Did I ever see him again? Unfortunately, no. He died in isolation, I think up in Montana, Idaho, or somewhere. He got divorced, and the Green Bay Packers let him go. I think he was only scouting for them for 1 year, and I don't know exactly what the cause of his death was, but I know he was alone when he died and when they found his body. So my disappointment is that we never did meet again. I would like to have had a dialogue with him and understand, where is he coming from? What pressures was he under? Why didn't he give us a voice? You know, why did he say the things that he did? You know, who was pressuring him? Because if you looked at some of the subsequent interviews of him on TV, his head was always dropped. His eyes were never up. His head was never up. And those were things that, you know, were bothered me for a long time. And then, of course, I had to come to grips with it when he finally did die, because it wasn't going to happen, you know. But
Mr. Hisaw, did you ever play football again after you were fired from Wyoming?
Good question. I went to Dallas Cowboys. You know, they have their training camp here in Southern California. When I went there, you know, it was with the intent of a tryout and find out if, you know, I could play with them without being drafted. Back then, they had waivers and no pickup options and a lot of different ways that would allow a player to come in as a walk-on. And after talking to the coaches and the staff, I was labeled as a rabble-rouser and a troublemaker, and because I was the most articulate during that time period and the most outspoken. So short answer, no, I didn't. but it wasn't because I didn't want to try.
The film is Black 14. You can see Black 14 by going to the website topic.com. Guillermo Hisaw was a member, the leader of the Black 14, an unsung civil rights leader of 1968 and 1969. Mr. Hisaw, it's been an honor.
Thank you. It's been mine as well.
And Darius Clark Monroe is the director of Black 14. Darius, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, that's all for us today. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and you can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.